So let me read something about the lobbying thing, just to, because there's a lot of talk about, well, everybody, they're lobbyists of all kinds. So it's money from business, money from unions, money, so it evens itself out. Well, here's a quote. Most of the money, but I have two quotes I want to read to you. Let me just find my way to the first one. Here we go. Individuals, organizations, and companies, this is from the New York Times, incidentally. Individuals, organizations, and companies gave a total of nearly $3 billion, this is in 2002, to national campaigns in 1999 and year 2000. However, organizations spend 10 times as much on lobbying as on direct campaign contributions, and they spend undisclosed millions more to establish special interest research institutes or so-called think tanks, which do not legally count as lobbying activities, but are intended to manipulate public opinion, public policy. Most of the money that goes into politics is to the politicians serving on congressional committees that oversee each industry. For example, most banking industry money goes to members of the finance committees, regardless of party. Business interests outgave labor interests by a factor of 11 to 1 in the 97-98 election. Dirty industries, oil and gas, mining, electricity, automobiles outspent the Greens more than 40 times. You understand? And so on. So everybody gives money, but the big money goes to the people who are. I just want to say something about the media. One can say there always been media, except one would say there's always been a medium of information, and that was newspapers and magazines. If you go back, no matter how far back you go, and so long as we're talking about the modern era. And it wasn't until the early 20th century that even began to change at all. I mean, newspapers, magazines, of course, became more widely read because literacy began to develop in some basic sense in the early 20th century. It wasn't until high school education became compulsory that really literacy became common. I mean, my mother, for example, never even went to high school, and she was born in this country. What really began to change things was electricity. The radio. The radio was developed for military purposes and was used first in World War I. And then, after World War I, and we're talking now about a period in which the United States economy became really, went from being a kind of a well-built kid to becoming a muscular giant because of World War I, in part. That is to say, we had the ability to make that big jump, and the war gave us the markets and so on and so on. And after World War I, in the 1920s, what you had was you still had, by using U.S. data, more than half of the population in the 1920s was living below the poverty level as we now define it. But still, you had a lot of people living above the poverty level who could buy things that had never even been thought of nor even produced because they hadn't been thought of before, namely consumer goods that are durable goods and so on. And also, it wasn't just that. It was a whole change of culture that went on in the 20s. The prosperity decade was also called the jazz age. Huh? Remember that? I remember it, as a matter of fact, as a kid. It was a time in which booze, liquor, was illegal. There was a lot of stuff going on between booze and dancing and music and so on and so on and so on. And the mere illegality of the booze made it popular, of course. And, of course, this is also when gangsterism in the United States began. The mafia became what it is now in the United States, not in Italy. I don't know how many of you know that. Al Capone was the one who helped that happen here. But what happened also is the radio became the first sort of mass medium thing in which you didn't even have to read. You just listen. And I remember when radio first happened, in my family we couldn't afford it until the late 20s, till about 1928, 29. Never had a radio. What my brother and I had was a crystal set. You know what a crystal set is? We had a little poke around with wires, a piece of crystal. Radio, with the evolution of radio, came the evolution of mass advertising for consumer goods. Okay? And it coincided with the fact that durable goods were durable meant that they lasted. And that was a problem for the companies that produced some of them. Most especially, it became a problem, as I talk about in the thing you might read, for automobiles. And it was in 1923, mind you, that the whole idea of consumerism in terms of consumer durable goods was invented by General Motors. The sales of automobiles, which had been going up from 1919 like this, flattened out by 1923. And the automobile companies must have continuous increases in their sales to use their productive capacity. So General Motors invented in 1923 what they called deliberate obsolescence or planned obsolescence. To have a car wear out every 3 years so that it had to get repairs. And you may or may not know this, the principal source of profits, the automobile companies, come from parts sales, but also selling more cars. And in order for them to sell more cars, they had to make it possible for people to buy them. And they also established the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, which is their bank. And they also had to advertise them. So these were the three things that happened. The General Motors itself started, except it was also starting at the same time for cigarettes and soap. Okay? And the cigarette thing, interestingly enough, as I talk about in there, cigarette thing was started, was done by, the cigarette advertising was done by, among other things, by a man named Edgar Bernays. And he was the guy who had worked for Woodrow Wilson to get the Americans to want to go into World War I. As some of you know, Woodrow Wilson campaigned in the 1916 election to keep the United States out of the war. At the same time, he has hired Bernays to go around the country and men's clubs and so on, pounding the drums for the United States to get into war. And Bernays was the guy who started Lucky Strikes thing, reach for lucky instead of a sweet, in other words, get skinny, and so on and so on and so on and so on. Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Poor old Siggy, he's going around in his grave still, having that kind of kid for a nephew. The radio, however, when you think about it, when you compare listening to a radio with watching a television set, it's not hypnotic. Television is hypnotic. Either you watch it and you're hypnotized by it, or you turn it off, one of the two. And it has the possibility of, well, I don't have to tell you. So it's television that really did it. Television plus World War II. Because television was invented, as you very probably know, in the 1920s. But it didn't become marketable because it cost a lot of money until after World War II. It was invented after World War I, but not, and so on. So what happened was, in the process of these technological developments and product developments, there also developed big business at the same time, going from big to giant business. Advertising evolved. And the kinds of people, I remember when I was going to the university as a student, right after World War II, being struck by the fact that there were so many young people I knew, people my age, who were studying sociology and psychology and planning to go to work in the advertising industry, psychology. And I thought, what are you doing? I was the one who was stupid. Because that's what it's all about, how to twist minds. There's a quote that, you've heard me say time and time again in here what Baran said, this lovely epigram of his, that monopoly capitalism teaches us to want what we don't need and not to want what we do. Well, he also had something to say about advertising, which is very good, which is I quote here. This is quoting Baran. He wrote this in the late 50s. It is crucial to recognize that advertising and mass media programs sponsored by and related to it do not to any significant extent create values or produce attitudes, but rather reflect existing and exploit prevailing attitudes. In so doing, they undoubtedly reinforce them and contribute to their propagation, but they cannot be considered to be their taproot. He's saying the same things that Veblen said. We are constructive and destructive instincts in this. Advertising campaigns succeed not if they seek to change people's attitudes, but if they manage to find, by means of motivation research and similar procedures, a way of linking up with existing attitudes. Status seeking and snobbery, sexual, racial, and sexual discrimination, egotism and unrelatedness to others, envy, gluttony, avarice, and ruthlessness in the drive for self-advancement. All those things that we prize in this country. All of these attitudes are not generated by advertising, but are made use of and appealed to in the contents of advertising material. And that's the problem. I mean, if we could blame the advertising industry for changing us, kind of a conspiracy to do that, that would be easier than to understand that what they're doing is really appealing to the worst in us, which is something which our whole socialization educational process strengthens in us anyway from the time that we're little boys and girls. And the same kinds of tactics that were used for selling products soon became, not noticeably until after World War II, at least in my own lifetime, became the way in which you sell ideas, ideology, and politicians and politics. And that's the kind of formidable obstacle that we have to try to overcome. And there's no way we can overcome it with just money, because when I say we, I mean the bottom 80% of the population. We don't have the money to do that. It has to be done with spirit and energy. It's the only way we can do it.
You've been listening to one of a series of lectures by Professor Doug Dowd from his free public class. Further reading on the topics he discusses is available on his website, dougdowd.org. Thanks to Michael Slaughter for making that tape available to us. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. Regular listeners are familiar with Dr. Michael Parenti, one of our most insightful, prolific, and plain-spoken social analysts. Next, Dory Smith of WHUS Stores speaks with him about a new book on a recurring theme.
Our guest today is Michael Parenti. His latest book is Super Patriots. You can learn more about Super Patriots and other titles by Michael Parenti on his website, michaelparenti.org. That's P-A-R-E-N-T-I for Parenti. I asked Michael Parenti to give us a definition of super patriotism and to talk about the contents of his new book.
It's the very troubling aspects of U.S. foreign policy that led me to raise some critical questions about the way the term and the concept of patriotism and love of country are used to justify all the kind of crimes that are being perpetrated in the name of patriotism. Our U.S. rulers play upon people's patriotism and love of country to get them to go along with policies that do not serve the interests of the American people and do not serve the interests of people in other countries. Under the guise of defending freedom, protecting us from terrorism, and the like, those of us who love our country are supposed to fall into line and support the invasion of Panama, the invasion of Grenada, the occupation of Somalia, the sending troops to Lebanon, the building of 700 major military bases in 56 different countries, the bombing of Yugoslavia for 78 days nonstop, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, the menacing a threat toward Iran, North Korea, China, the constant conjuring up of adversaries who may threaten us, and under the guise of defending us from these threats and such, people fall into line. In fact, what U.S. rulers are doing are building a global empire that serves the needs of giant multinational corporations that batten on the huge contracts that are set forth. Consider Iraq, for instance, the billions of dollars that Halliburton and Bechtel and other companies, about 70 other companies, have made. Billions and billions of dollars in profit. A lot of it unaccountable, a lot of it not even properly supervised. In Iraq, well, you see, to say that Bush's policy in Iraq has backfired or is a failure is not true. It's quite successful for certain interests. They're sitting on $5 trillion worth of oil in Iraq. They have no exit strategy. People say they have no exit strategy as if you're really exposing their stupidity and all that. But they have no exit strategy because they don't want any exit strategy. They're not intending to exit. They're sitting on $5 trillion worth of oil, the largest oil grab in the history of humanity. And to justify all of this, they wave the flag in people's faces, and many people fall into line. And those of us who criticize such policies and say, wait a minute, these policies are built on deception. These policies benefit the privileged investing class at the expense of the U.S. taxpayers, and we expend our taxes and the blood of our sons and daughters and husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, whatever, to support that. And people fall into line because the flag is waved and, you're told to be a good American, that you got to back the president, and that's that. And those of us who are critics are accused of lacking patriotism. You must be making these criticisms because you don't love your country. For some strange reason, you live here, you work here, and all that, but you don't love your country the way I love my country, and I love my country because I unquestioningly submit to whatever the president wants. He wants more taxes to support his wars. I pay more taxes. He wants the blood of my son or daughter or brother or whatever. I go along with that, too. Well, that such a person is not the citizen of a democracy. Such a person is not the citizen of a democratic polity. He's a citizen of a totalitarian mentality. And so patriotism has been used in this way. I call it super patriotism because it's an unthinking, knee-jerk thing which equates more and more military expenditure and military strength with patriotism. It equates attacking and waging wars on other people with love of country and the like. And most of these super patriots know very little about the history of their country. They know very little about the really wonderful things in our history. So you wonder what it is they really love about their country. They know very little about the struggles for the eight-hour day, the struggles for organized labor, the struggles for public education, for medical care for the ill and indigent, the struggle for decent housing, the struggles against racism and segregation, the struggles against sexism, against class oppression, the fight for progressive income taxes and such. Many of these victories being now undone by the Bush administration in the last 20 years, by the Reagan administration and others. So they don't. What is it they love about the country? They know very little about the darker side of our history also, about the terrible epic of slavery, about the terrible oppression of working people in America, child labor, the terrible conditions of our medical industry, our pharmaceuticals and the like. And you can go on and on and on, the plight and the plunder and desecration of the environment. There's that other whole side which they don't even want to look at, and if you do criticize, they see you as being, again, anti-American and lacking in patriotism. So patriotism for these people is to be a mindless, flag-waving, follow-the-leader sort of drone, you know. Saddam Hussein, in his worst days as a torturer and a murderer and an oppressor, was supported by the CIA and the U.S. government. He was Washington's poster boy. He was put in. He was backed for assassination gigs back in 1959. He was the man who destroyed and killed and murdered every communist, every progressive, every Democrat, every constitutionalist, or drove them in exile or underground. He even wiped out the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist party. And when he was doing all of that, he was Washington's hero. They gave him aid. They had nothing but the highest praise for him. It's when he got out of line on the oil quotas and oil prices, and he wanted a bigger share of the market to sell, and they were worried about oil prices dropping. It was when he proved himself not to be a complete comprador leader, opening up his country completely to foreign investment on terms that were entirely favorable to the big foreign investors. When he started doing that, this was when they started finding fault with him. He started committing economic nationalism. He kept the whole economy publicly owned rather than privatizing it, handing it over to the corporations at garage sale prices. He trained cadres of engineers. He started developing Iraq. Now, Iraq is a very crucial nation in the Middle East. If you ever look at the map of the Middle East, it is the hub, the center. It borders on six other very important countries, including Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Syria. It's the one country. A lot of countries in the Middle East have water but no oil, or oil but no water. Iraq had both. It's very prosperous. It had a standard of living that was the highest in the Middle East. Today, it's a country that's been reduced to utter desperation and destruction. And what the U.S. has done is worsen the conditions of the people, increase the dangers of violence and death, destroyed the economy. I was just reading about a U.S. Marine who's come back, and he said he went to Iraq thinking he was going to be fighting and defending people and helping reconnect their water supply and electricity and sewage systems. And in fact, he was put on parole to guard the oil wells and pipelines. And he said large numbers of the troops, that's why the military force in the U.S. military force in Iraq, one of the reasons why it's so ineffectual is a huge chunk of it. Nobody ever talks about that. A huge chunk of it is out there guarding the wellheads and the pipelines and whatever else, and having a hard time of it, too, because it's hard to guard and patrol hundreds of miles of pipeline. This is what's developed. There wasn't an al-Qaeda terrorist network in Iraq until the U.S. invasion. Today, they've attracted every group, they'll perpetrator, whatever else, every violent nut that you can think of is now in that country, blowing up things and killing people. They're not, I'm sorry to say, the insurgency is not a people's war of national liberation, which would build cadres and help the people and build schools and whatever things the way such wars of national liberation have done in some countries. It's just a hit-and-run group made worse, as I say, attracting and multiplying in numbers with every day of the U.S. occupation. So the occupation has really, really been the worst thing for peace, the worst thing for the well-being of the Iraqi people, and it's now creating a Frankenstein monster that will lead, as you said, to civil war, probably, and to the most extreme form of Islamic oppression. And the longer the U.S. stays there, the worse it gets, despite the window dressing of a constitution and an election. But 90% of the violence and such is because of the U.S. presence and occupation. Even the people who say, yes, I'm glad you overthrew Saddam Hussein, now would you please go home? That's what they say. So that's really the answer. And what I would invite people to do is look at the underlying interests behind all these interventions. Why does this country, why do these rulers feel so compelled to have to intervene everywhere, have troops in 56 different countries, getting involved in military actions in Somalia, Yugoslavia, Panama, Grenada, supporting all sorts of other groups in Colombia and all through Latin America, fighting everywhere to make the world safe for the Fortune 500, to make the world safe for George Bush's plutocracy and reactionaries. And that has nothing to do with patriotism and nothing to do with freedom, nothing to do with national security, and nothing to do with democracy. It's just the opposite. It creates more problems for all of us. But it gives them a lot of gains and a lot of advantages. My point is, it's incorrect to say that the Iraq policy isn't working. It is working. It is working. It's doing what they want. They've got control of the oil, and they're exporting it, and they've stripped a government that was 95% state-owned, and they're privatizing it. They have special committees to privatize it. They've taken a country that was self-defining and self-developing, and it is now an impoverished, prostrate, devastated country where people will line up to work for slave wages or become members of the police or army because it's the only jobs they can get and serve as adjuncts to U.S. imperialism. The policy is working for certain very select interests. And as far as everyone else, to hell with them. It doesn't matter. And so the peace movement should be making it clear, you know, cui bono, who benefits from this policy? And to assume that nobody is benefiting, nobody is being served, this is just a total disaster. It's just getting worse and worse. If you think your enemies who control so much power, so much of the world, so much wealth, if you think they're stupid, you're being stupid. They know what the hell they're doing. Of course, there's been unexpected and very costly responses. And they didn't expect an insurgency of the kind they got. They thought it would be a walk-in and a waltz. But they're not paying the price on that. They're even profiting from that. It's enabling them to boost the military, U.S. military budget to record heights, $440 billion, not to mention the off-budget expenditures day-to-day in Iraq, which come to billions, $1.5 billion a day more, which will starve out the human services here at home, give them greater justification to cut back on Social Security payments and Medicare and housing and education, all those things, get us back to a third world nation. Their goal is the impoverishment of the world. The poorer they can make you or the Iraqis or other people, the poorer and hungrier they can make people, the harder those people will work for less and less, and the more profits they themselves will make. So that's where I see the policy going. And as I said, they have no exit policy because they have no intention of exiting. They have been in Korea for 50 years, a half a century, and they're quite prepared to stay in Iraq for half a century. They won't say that to people because they're losing, you know, 50 to 70 soldiers and Marines a month. But that's a sustainable loss. You know, Richard Nixon was losing 110 a week in Vietnam, and he got reelected in 1972 by a landslide. And even among the people who lose their children, you get these interviews, a lot of them, a lot, not all, but a lot of them come out and say, my son wanted to serve, and I'm proud of him, and he died so that we could be free. And it's the land of the free because we have the home of the brave, because the brave have made us free. And I mean, there are people in America who really think we're defending freedom in Iraq. We're defending our own freedom. And the whole trick is to see, to try to, as I tried to do in the book, Super Patriotism, to try to show them that this isn't in their interest, but it is in the interest of other people.
We've been interviewing people here on Talk Nation like Gareth Porter, who have discussed the idea that we need to identify those in Iraq who might need to negotiate so that we can try to help stabilize Iraq and provide a way toward peace talks.
It really varies. It's really a mess because you have Shiite and Sunni who are already at loggerheads and killing each other and doing preliminary civil war. You have Shiites and Sunni who are working together and saying there are no differences. We're all Iraqis and we have only one common enemy, which the U.S. should get out now. And you have Kurds who want to collaborate, but most Kurds are, or the element that has been most supported and financed by the U.S., is the separatist element, because the function of the Kurds is to be a separatist, undermining the existing Iraqi government. So if they can negotiate and get a broad-based coalition which says we're going to live in peace and restructure our government and we don't need you Americans now, and we've put a damper enough on the insurgents and the terrorists so you can go home now, that would be very nice. And yes, sure, we should support those elements. But it doesn't really look like those are the people who are calling the tune. You know, there's just so much one can say, or one could go on and on. But underlying the assumption here is that the U.S. has a right to be in any country it wants to go to and try to solve, supposedly, or at least pretend to solve the problems of that country, when in fact it's the creator of many of the worst problems. And that mission is the messianic mission. I talk about that in Super Patriotism, that there's a presumption not only among the leaders, but it's propagated among large sections of our population, that our country, for some reason, has been called upon by history to go forth and define the fate and destinies of other countries and define how they shall develop, how they shall govern themselves. The idea that that the U.S. rulers have the right to go into Iraq to help them and teach them how to govern themselves. Here's a 5,000-year-old civilization where many of the things in Western civilization started in Iraq. I mean, things like the alphabet and writing and this, that, and the other thing. And to announce that we've come to help these lesser people who somehow are just lesser. They're not really quite as sharp or as gifted or as great as we Americans are. And they could be Iraqis today. Yesterday they were Panamanians. The day before they were Croatians and Serbians. And again and again there's this presumption of supremacy There's this presumption of the U.S. being God's gift to humanity, God's gift to history, and that it will step forward and it will guide these countries. And meanwhile, what they're doing is bombing villages, destroying their farms, destroying their homes, killing large numbers of them, blasting away, and they're hated. And if we are so gifted, if we are so generous, if we are so much the savior throughout the world, why are we so hated? And George Bush was asked that question. I have a whole chapter in the book. It's a short chapter. Why do they hate us? And he said, I don't know. We're such wonderful people. Well, it must be, they're just crazy. They just hate us. Why don't you take a look at what they say? They say, leave us alone. You come in, you take over our country, you steal our resources, you push aside our governments, you support the most retrograde, repressive elements in our society, you set up dictatorships when we had started democratic movements, you do all this, you steal our markets, our land, our capital, our labor, our natural resources, and all the while you're preaching to us about democracy and peace and love and freedom and all that stuff. And the truth is, your whole policy is based on lies and hypocrisy. And the only way we're going to get this through to your people is by bringing the war home to you. And this is what they say. Now, I don't back those people. I hate all these forms of violence and madness that are going on. But you can understand that they're not waging war against America because they're just so jealous. Osama bin Laden was right when he said, if we're fighting you just because we don't like you because you're so free and you're so prosperous and you're so democratic, then why don't we attack Sweden or Denmark? They're freer and more prosperous and more democratic than you are. He said, we attack you because you're over here. Our war is not a war of aggression against you. It's a war of retaliation. If you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. And that's what they say again and again. And that's the message that is played down. Instead, what Americans believe is we've got some mission with destiny or history to save the world and be the superpower leaders of the world. And in fact, having so much power, you even get media pundits who then transcribe that power into entitlement. We are a superpower, and we better act like a superpower. We have the right to, we have the power, therefore we have the right to. And we got to get out there, and we got to make those decisions and take on those responsibilities. Who said so? Who said and why? If you're so hot to prove how great America is, why don't you start right here at home and start solving some of the problems right here in the U.S. that are so immense and so troubling? Instead of running to every little corner of the world to go bomb and occupy and spend billions of dollars of our tax money while we get poorer and poorer here at home.
Michael Parenti is author of 18 books. His new book is Super Patriots. He's also written The Terrorism Trap, History as Mystery, Inventing Reality, and many more titles.
And the interviewer was Dory Smith of Radio Talk Nation in Storrs, Connecticut. Born again? Yes, sir. Next, Barry Vogel of Radio Curious in Ukiah, California, looks at revelations of compulsory religion in the military.
There are concerns that evangelical Christianity is close to being officially sanctioned at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado, as well as within other areas of the United States military forces. In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit some of these issues with Mikey Weinstein, a graduate of the Air Force Academy, a businessman, and a former attorney in the Reagan White House. Mikey Weinstein describes how evangelical Christianity appears to have become the standard within the United States Military Academy that trains future leaders of the United States Air Force. At the beginning of an Air Force career, each new cadet, among many other things, takes an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. These cadets are led by Brigadier General Johnny A. Wieda, the current Air Force Academy Commandant of Cadets. On the Air Force website, under Character Development, Brigadier General Wieda is quoted as saying, "Our primary purpose is to ensure every graduate has the character, honor, integrity, sense of service, and excellence required of a second lieutenant in the world's greatest air and space force. On July 29, 2005, the name of Brigadier General Ueda, the number two officer at the Air Force Academy, was deleted from a list of Air Force generals to be promoted shortly before the United States Senate voted on those promotions. An April 28, 2005 report by Americans United for Separation of Church and State accused Brigadier General Ueda of proselytizing to the cadets and specifically endorsing evangelical Christianity at the Air Force Academy. It's been suggested that this may be a reason why he was not promoted. This interview with Mikey Weinstein, who worked as Assistant General Counsel in the Reagan White House Office of Administration, was recorded by telephone from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on August 3, 2005. Mikey Weinstein, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Tell us what's going on in the United States Air Force Academy and, to a greater extent, throughout the United States military with regard to religious orientation.
Well, I fear that we are losing our country. If we lose our, you know, our military, in many respects, I guess I could describe it as a miner's canary. And if the separation, the wall of separation between church and state, can be breached, and not just breached but obliterated willfully in the U.S. military, then it can happen any place, because that's why it's a great miner's canary.
Well, how is that being obliterated or being breached in the U.S. military now?
Well, let me give you a little bit about my background first so you know from where I'm speaking. I'm an Air Force Academy graduate. My father's a Naval Academy graduate. My brother-in-law is an Air Force Academy graduate. My eldest son and his wife are both Air Force Academy graduates, and my youngest son is a third-year cadet, what's called a second classman, at the Air Force Academy now. So we're three generations of military academies, and in my family, in my immediate family, we have 115 years of active duty military service to the country, including right now in all wars from, you know, World War II to the current conflict. And I have never seen anything like this before. When Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, Barry, came out in February of 2004, I was contacted not by my three kids who were at the Air Force Academy at the time, but by Christian members of the faculty, because I was pretty prominent, pretty well known there. I've given a lot of blood, sweat, tears, and money to my alma mater over the years, wanting to know if I knew what was going on at the academy. And I said, what are you talking about? And the entire campus had been massively covered in pamphlets exhorting everyone to go see this movie, which I often refer to as the Jesus Chainsaw Murders or Freddy versus Jesus, if you saw the movie. And it turned out, as I began to peel the onion back over the months, this is not a Christian-Jewish thing. It's a evangelical Christian versus everybody else thing. I've had probably 700 to 800 people, staff, faculty, cadets, former staff, coaches at the academy come to me anonymously. The vast majority will not even let me tell their anonymous fact patterns to the press for fear that the Air Force authorities will be able to triangulate the anonymous fact patterns and identify them. I do have 117 people that will let me tell their stories. Only 8 are Jews. One's Islamic, one's atheist, 12 are Catholic. The rest are Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Episcopalian. They're just not used to being preyed upon, P-R-A-Y, and P-R-E-Y, by fellow Christians and being told that they're going to burn eternally in hell.
Well, how do they do this? What's going on? What are the specifics at the academy?
I'll give you some examples. We think it's gone back at least 20 years, but in the early 90s, the Air Force Academy sanctioned its famous parachute jump team on the same day that Dr. Dobson, James Dobson, and Focus on the Family opened up their vast campus right across the street from the academy, across Interstate 25, sanctioned the jump team to come out of the jump out of the sky carrying, quote, the keys of heaven. They landed on the front lawn of Focus on the Family, gathered up their parachutes, and walked the keys over to Dr. Dobson. They routinely have brown bag lunches. There was one just last year, a very common example, with flyers out in front of the lectinars that are attended by senior officers in uniform. The flyer usually says, this is co-sponsored by the Christian Leadership Ministries and the U.S. Air Force Academy. Do not take this flyer down. And the one in January of last year, do you know what the title was for that particular lunch?
Tell us.
Why We, meaning the evangelicals who are sponsoring it, cannot let you have your God while we have ours. That's pretty shocking. just last year, when all the brand new cadets, the new class of 2008 at that time, had come in, they were out in the remote area of the academy called Jack's Valley for the combat field training. There was a Protestant service that was held on a particular night when half the class was showed up. They thought it was to be an ecumenical service, along with seven members of the Yale Divinity School, who were visiting to help advise the academy as to how they could increase their unit cohesion between the chaplains. They have 3.2 basketball teams of them there, 16 chaplains and the cadets and staff. They were shocked when an Air Force chaplain got on the stage, went into a massive fire and brimstone lecture, and then exhorted his young charges to, when they left to leave, it was an outdoor amphitheater, when they left the makeshift amphitheater, go back to their tents and immediately confront their classmates who did not attend the evangelical service, interrogate them as to what their religions were. If they weren't evangelical Christians, they were to be evangelized on the spot. And if the recipients resisted evangelization, they were to be told that the penalty for such apostasy would be that they would burn eternally in hell. When this was recorded in the official Yale report as to what they saw, the Air Force Academy said, well, we can't really confirm that this happened, although, as you might imagine, I've had a zillion people come forward to me telling me that it happened. Then the Air Force Academy said that they thought it might have been a reserve chaplain who did that. It turned out to be, of course, the reigning Air Force Chaplain of the Year, Major Warren Chappie Watiss. The 700 chaplains, he'd just been selected fairly recently as the Chaplain of the Year. I can go on and on and on. The Commandant of Cadets there invented a call-and-response concept when he would yell at the cadet wing, air power, and they were supposed to yell back, rock, sir. And that was based on the New Testament parable of the man who builds his house on shifting sands. The house can't survive in a storm, but he who builds the house on a rock, i.e. the rock of Christ, has a very firm foundation. And the Commandant thought this would be a good way for the cadets to kind of help evangelize other cadets. It was astonishing.
What's your take on why it is occurring the way it is, being permitted, not being stopped?
From 1993, Barry, until 2003, when I put a stop to it in 2004, the back of the base newspaper, and for your listeners that don't know, every Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard station around the world has its own completely federally funded base newspaper. It's weekly. The Air Force Academy is no different. Just like West Point and Annapolis, they have a weekly paper. For that 10-year period, in the edition right before Christmas, the back page of the paper contained a solicitation that said the following: we, the undersigned, are here to state that the only real hope for mankind is Jesus Christ. If you'd like to talk about Jesus, please come by and see one of us. It was signed by 16 academic department heads or deputy heads, 9 permanent professors, the then-current dean, the current dean now, the then-current vice dean, the director of athletics, the head football coach, and 250 of the other senior adults, leaders at the academy, and their spouses, along with 4 of the most sectarian vitriolic quotations out of the New Testament. I think that the academy is under such a spotlight now that, you know, when someone sneezes, they're afraid to say God bless you. But I'm very sorry to have to report to your listenership out there that on July 12th, just about 3 weeks ago, on the front page of the number one most visible newspaper in the world, and probably the most hated newspaper by the Pentagon, a senior Air Force leader announced that it was Air Force policy that the Air Force would, on its own, as we lawyers would say, sua sponte, determine who was and who wasn't unchurched, and the Air Force reserved the right to evangelize those that it determines to be unchurched. I know it's hard to believe. I mean, it's August of 2005, but your United States Air Force, that is their policy. We will determine who is churched and unchurched, and those who are unchurched, we reserve the right, as the United States Air Force, to evangelize them. That has gone unrebutted in the New York Times for the last 3 weeks and a day.
Is that taken to mean churched in an evangelical sense with the exclusion of everything else?
Well, see, the problem that the guy who said it was the number 2 ranking chaplain, Brigadier General Cecil R. Richardson in the United States Air Force. I'd like to know, I have 3 children on active duty in the U.S. Air Force. I'd like to know whether or not they fall into the unchurched category, since there is no operational definition of that. And if so, is the United States Air Force going to reserve its right to evangelize my children? I'd like to know.
What have you done to find out the answer to that question?
Well, I'm close to bringing a lawsuit.
Can you describe for us what the lawsuit is and what the parameters are?
I can tell you this, that the lawsuit would come from a very well-recognized advocacy group in Washington, D.C. This is far beyond putting up 10 commandments, you know, in a courtroom or outside of a courtroom. This is way beyond that. I was told by Rabbi Arnold Resnikoff, who just was recently put into his position as special advisor for something called Vision and Values to the acting Secretary of the Air Force, when I confronted him with this, I told him, you know, that I felt he deserved a grade of F for his several weeks in his job so far. He admitted to me that I was fighting the good fight, that this churched and unchurched problem and reserving the right to evangelize them was very, very real. Look, it's a serious thing when you realize that the Islamic fundamentalists that we are fighting in the Middle East view this as a cosmic battle, both here on earth and in heaven, between Christianity and Islam. It's a mistake to think that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and Osama bin Laden and the other, the jihadists, the insurrectionists, the remnants of the Taliban, the al-Qaeda cells, Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Islamic Jihad, any of them, don't get on the Internet and they're not completely aware of everything that happens over here. If they see our U.S. military that actually does have and control WMD, which when Saddam had none, professing one religion over the other, one God better than another. I mean, I can't say it better than that brown bag lunch at the academy. Why we cannot let you have your God and we have ours. Well, Barry, it's a serious, serious, serious problem.
What has caused the problem to be this way? What is your view of American history in the past 20, 25 years that brings this to a head now?
Well, I spent over 3 years in the West Wing of the Reagan White House. My last job there was Assistant General Counsel in the White House Office of Administration. I saw the evangelical movement back in the early mid-80s start generating itself, and certainly for the Air Force Academy, rearing its ugly head there geographically makes perfect sense because Colorado Springs is kind of the evangelical capital of the world. Over 100 of this nation's largest evangelical organizations, for some reason, are attracted like a moth to a flame there. Certainly the fact that we have this particular administration in place right now with a born-again president, but that isn't it by itself because, you know, Jimmy Carter was born again, but we didn't have the same issue. It seems to me that basically you've seen a morphing in the Republican Party to where they used to be the party of the Bible. They're not anymore, Barry. Now, that, in my opinion, they're the party only of the New Testament, and the only party left that can be remotely, you know, connected with the U.S. Constitution are the Democrats.
Mikey, where is this going? What can be done about it?
What I do when I am asked this question, I'm reminded of a quote from, ironically, a virulent anti-Semite, well-known. His name was T.S. Eliot. His quote was, that you've probably heard before, Barry, "The end of the world shall come, the end of the world shall come, the end of the world shall come, not with a bang, but a whimper." And I think back to what my great aunt told me, who passed away here in Albuquerque 5 or 6 weeks ago at the age of 91. She was a Holocaust survivor. She exhorted me never to forget how it was when she lived in Berlin in the late 20s, when the first little signs started to come out. The Jews had, for the license plates for their cars, had to have a certain number of alphanumerics that all the same. And then Jews could not congregate in groups larger than 50 or 20 or 15 or 12 or 3. And before you knew it, there was nothing left to do because the world had ended, and it had ended with a whimper because of death by a thousand cuts. I'm asking people to scream into the wind with me before there's no energy left to scream into the wind. Write your congressman and your congresswoman. Contact your senators. Tell them that you refuse to pay to live in a country where the armed forces it has it as a policy that it will evangelize. It is pushing just one religious philosophy over all the others, telling everybody else whose God is better than the other God. We have a tradition in this country. It's not a tradition. I mean, those 16 golden words, Barry, of the First Amendment: Congress shall make no law with respect to establishing a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Most of America lives very happily between the free exercise clause and the no establishment clause. But in Colorado Springs and in many other parts of the country, that happy land between those two clauses has been brutalized, assaulted, tortured, and bludgeoned into a poison no man's land. People have got to contact their representatives. They've got to say, we're not going to put up with this. Americans have a tradition of not changing presidents during wartime, but we have one of these off elections coming again. We saw what happened to Newt Gingrich and the others after one of the Clinton took office, when that the extreme right wing was really blown out of the water. And I think we saw with what happened in Ohio yesterday with Mr. I think it was Mr. Hacker is his name, got 48% of the vote in a losing effort as a Democrat in a district that was 72% Republican. And we've got to fight back, and we got to start fighting back now. Literally before all we have left is a whimper.
What about Donald Rumsfeld and what you characterize as his inaction?
I feel that Donald Rumsfeld and other key people in his chains of command are essentially committing sedition at best and at worst treason. They owe it to our troops not to take away any of the good order and unit cohesion we have, but by sitting back with acts of omission and commission, with regard to the pushing of one religion over the other, when we're at war with an enemy that sees us already one-dimensionally as Christian crusaders, That is a direct violation of the U.S. Constitution. Everyone there took an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the U.S. Constitution, not to preserve, protect, or defend the Torah, the Old Testament, the Koran, or the New Testament. And while we sit here, as the days go by in the summer of 2005, we're hearing lots of loud bangs, and nobody's doing anything.
Do you think that this is coming from the Air Force alone, or a policy of the Department of Defense, or something that's known by President Bush and tacitly acknowledged?
Oh, I think it's clearly the latter. This comes right out of the West Wing. I'm not a neophyte. I spent over 3 years in the Reagan White House, and back then, the right-wing evangelicals were trying to get a senior White House official with clear access to the president. Long ago, they stopped trying to do that. Why? Because they have the president. You've got a president who clearly, views one particular religion as being supreme over the others, and this is exactly where they're getting their direction from. The American people cannot have our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, our liberties hijacked by these people. And when you think about it, I tend to think of things mathematically and scientifically. Of all the scientific disciplines, they are all derivative from one mothership, right, which is the discipline of mathematics. In our country, almost every major issue, stem cell research, abortion, even the reason we're in this war, seems to all be coming from the mothership of religion. Last year, the big issues in this country were red state versus blue state. This year, it's religion. And the right-wing evangelicals right now have the West Wing. They have both houses of Congress. Do you know that over 130 members of the United States House of Representatives describe themselves as being born again? And they're about to get the Supreme Court. Sadly, with Sandra Day O'Connor gone, John Roberts Jr. was on staff with me at the White House. We barely knew each other. But he has his record as being Deputy Solicitor General when it comes to trying to change the famous Lemon Test from the U.S. Supreme Court on church-state is dismal. And we are in real danger here. Now, the evangelicals overstepped themselves with the Schiavo case. 82% of the American public thought it was terrible that, Bush left Crawford, Texas, trying to, pass a law to protect the life of this longtime vegetative, state brain-dead woman. I don't think they're going to make that same mistake again. They're going to be more subtle about it. But there's videotape of Bush standing up in front of churches talking about his faith-based initiative and telling the congregation not to worry about what they fear about all the entanglements of a big government handbook and of regulations about how to handle the money, Barry. Because he then turns to the choir director and says, let me borrow my handbook. And he holds up the Bible, says, here's the only handbook you need for the faith-based initiatives. That is not what, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, that is not what this country was founded upon. It's not just a bad idea, it is not just illegal, it is dangerous to all of our health to have our government, and in particular our military, pushing one religious philosophy to the exclusion of all others.
Do you feel that the all others, those who are not evangelical, are equally identified, or do you feel that certain groups are being particularly identified?
No, it's a very interesting phenomenon. It is clearly the evangelicals versus everybody else. This is I'm Jewish. I grew up in this country, love this country. I understand what it means to be a minority. From the first time I was a little kid, and I understood that we were not the majority religion, and that I was different in a certain way. What is astonishing to me are all the people that have come to me every day. More come. Who are mostly Protestants, a few Catholics, who are not used to this. I've had families from farm families from Middle America contact me because they thought they had churched their children well, but they've been turned at the Air Force Academy, the evangelical zombie robots, who call them up on the phone crying, "Mommy and Daddy, you will not be joining me in eternal paradise because you're going to burn in hell. You don't accept Christ the right way." So it's a very interesting phenomenon where you have those that were formerly in the majority being told by an extremely controlling, dominionist-oriented evangelical vocal minority that you're not Christian enough, you're going to burn in hell. It's all about the evangelical perspective that while we may be of this earth, or in this earth, we are not of this earth. Our place is the place hereafter. And the entire focus on everything, I've had people in uniform, senior people, look at me and tell me to my face that Jack Benny, Dr. Seuss, Albert Einstein, and sadly, little Anne Frank, who wrote the diary, are all burning eternally in the lake of fire for rejecting Christ.
You've mentioned some examples of the farm families, and you earlier mentioned there are 117 different people who said share their fact pattern.
Yes.
Can you give us some of those fact patterns?
I've had officers tell me that they've been pressured by superiors to attend services, evangelical services. I've had a female C-130 pilot, a graduate, tell me that when she was an NCAA athlete at the Air Force Academy, she was pressured not to go to Mass as a Catholic on Sunday, but to come to evangelical services by her coach, who would pull the entire team off the Academy reservation to go to an evangelical church downtown together. I've had cadets tell me that when they were studying the Holocaust and class materials were passed out, an evangelical cadet looked at a Jewish cadet and passed the materials and said, "You see what happens because you killed Jesus?" There was a popular joke at the Academy as to why Jews are the best magicians. Do you know why, Barry? Jews are the best magicians because they have the unique ability to walk into a red brick building and come out in the smokestacks in a puff of smoke.
And they're saying that at the Air Force Academy.
Yes. Now, I don't think they're saying it now. When I was first contacted, of course, I worked very closely with the Academy for the first 8 months before I realized it was a lost cause at that time. And then I've created a very gigantic media storm there. I've been on every cable and terrestrial network, hundreds of radio shows, TV shows. So now I think the Academy is best described as a flying donkey. And that is to say, Barry, that when a donkey flies, you really don't expect it to stay up very long. And the only adult that came forward out there was a true American hero, Captain Melinda Morton, who came out for 100 days. She was a ordained Lutheran minister, a lawyer, a former Air Force missile launch officer, a PhD, and a member of the chaplain staff, who said that it's horrible here. And they chewed her up so badly that she resigned 48 hours ago. On July 31st, she resigned from the Air Force.
And prior to her resignation, wasn't she transferred to Japan?
Yes, she was being forced. She got a no-notice assignment to Okinawa, where she was told she would deploy at least twice into the combat zones of Iraq and Afghanistan. And, of course, the Air Force said that was mere happenstance, which, of course, is a bunch of garbage. The people live in complete and total abject fear that if they come forward. I had a Jewish member of the faculty, when his boss, an evangelical Christian, left, he left him a letter saying, "I wish you the best of luck, and I've enjoyed teaching with you. I want you to know that every night my wife and I get down on our knees in our bedroom and pray for the salvation of your family, that you will make the discovery that only Jesus Christ and only Jesus Christ is our Savior and the way to salvation." How do you think that made that person feel, having been a subordinate? It's unbelievable. Then, of course, there's my son. My youngest son is the one that told me 6 months after I was working with the Academy. He asked to go off base at a conference I was attending at the Academy as a distinguished graduate. And he said that he wanted to warn me and warn his mother, wanted me to carry this back to his mother, that he was very likely going to be court-martialed and getting into trouble. And I was stunned. I said, "Well, what did you do? And I'll never forget it. I get goose pimples telling you now. He said, "Dad, it's not what I did. It's what I'm about to do." And the next person that calls me an effing Jew or accuses me or our people of the execution of Jesus Christ, I'm going to beat the S out of. And, I was one of these people born without a temper, Barry, but I'm not going to have that happen in this country, in this month, and in this year. And as you peel the onion back, even today I received notification of a Billy Graham Evangelical Association, a military ministry. It was an email that went out to all commanders of all these Eastern Coast Army and Air Force installations, bragging about military folks in uniform that will be talking about military ministry for enlisted people, officers, chaplains, non-chaplains, how we can spread the word of Jesus. It was sent out by a retired two-star general in the Army. One of the speakers is an active duty general in the Army. It's unbelievable. They have a picture of Army folks with civilians with by a river, in uniform, all praying together. This has nothing at all to do, by the way, with trying to banish God. I hope people that gloriously and comprehensively, celebrate their religions. It's just you can't do it when you engage the machinery of the state. I would like to give you one more example, if I could. It had been in the past very common for evangelical instructors at the Academy to greet their classes on the very first day. "Hello, my name is Major Smith. Welcome to Physics 101 or Chem 101. I want you to know that I'm a born-again Christian, and if you're not one, I hope you will be by the end of the semester." Does anyone see a problem with this?
And finally, if somebody wants to contact you or the organizations that you're working with, how can they do that?
they can contact me. I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's Mikey Weinstein, and I'm in the phone book.
And the interviewer was Barry Vogel of Radio Curious in Ukiah, California. You can download MP3s of this and previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests from our online archive at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. Just like